This program is provided by lawyer Kyungjin Kim.
Right now, your daily life, your emails, your medical records, your commute, even your cultural history, all of it is being pumped into these massive server farms.
Right, usually sitting thousands of miles away.
Exactly. You, and honestly, the country you live in, are basically giving away your most valuable territory for free.
Yeah, it's a huge blind spot for most people.
It really is. So to understand why this is happening and, you know, how to stop it, I want you to picture the outer edges of the ancient Roman Empire.
Okay, setting the scene. I like it.
Right. So amidst all the dust and the absolute chaos of expansion, the Romans operated with this like profound, dignified calm. When they conquered new territory, they didn't just plant a flag and call it a day.
No, they laid down stones.
Massive, meticulously cut stones to build the Appian and Aurelian ways.
And the underlying philosophy there was honestly strategically brilliant in its simplicity. I mean, if a road does not exist, the legion cannot move. And if the legion cannot move, well, that land isn't truly Roman.
It's just a spot on a map. Those roads were the physical arteries through which Roman will, their law, and their culture flowed out into the world. If you controlled the roads, you completely controlled the reality of that territory.
Which brings us to the modern parallel.
Exactly. Fast forward 2,000 years, and you have Jensen Huang, the CEO of NVIDIA, traveling the globe with a strikingly similar message for world leaders.
But obviously, the roads he's helping to build aren't asphalt or stone.
No, they're made of fiber optic cables and these massive AI factories. And the territory they're trying to secure is this invisible but very real domain called data.
It is, without a doubt, the ultimate modern territory. I mean, the stakes for controlling it are just as high as they were in antiquity.
Right.
Because if you can't process your own data, you don't truly control your own nation.
Which is exactly what we're getting into today. Welcome to today's deep dive. We are exploring a single vital chapter from the book Jensen Huang, Caesar of Silicon.
Great title, by the way.
It really fits. We're zeroing in on this highly provocative concept known as sovereign AI. We're going to unpack why data has basically surpassed oil as the most valuable resource on Earth.
And how a new kind of digital imperialism is threatening nations.
Yeah, and why this global scramble to build these so-called digital walls is completely redrawing the geopolitical map of the 21st century.
To really see this shift taking place, you have to look at where this specific doctrine of sovereign AI was formally introduced to the world stage.
Right, take us back to that.
So we go to February 2024 at the World Government Summit in Dubai.
Just a massive gathering.
Huge. Picture over 4,000 delegates representing 150 different countries. The entire global establishment is basically packed into this venue.
And Jensen Huang is up on stage having a conversation with the UAE's AI minister, Omar Alama, right?
Exactly. And during this talk, Huang drops this specific phrase, sovereign AI.
Which sounds cool, but what does it actually mean in practice?
Well, to grasp the weight of that phrase, you have to consider the root of the word sovereignty. This actually goes way back to the Westphalian system.
Oh, right. The 17th century treaty stuff.
Yeah, that diplomatic agreement that basically established the modern nation state. It essentially said, you know, your borders are your borders and no outside power gets to dictate what happens inside them.
A nation has the absolute right to govern itself.
Exactly. So Huang took this bedrock geopolitical concept and applied it directly to artificial intelligence. He's saying every single country needs to have its own AI infrastructure. You can't just, like, borrow someone else's.
Let's contextualize this for the listener using the book's parallel to 19th century colonialism, because I found this fascinating. Think about the extractive economy of that era.
Right. The mother country and the colonies.
Yes. You had colonial powers, and you had these colonies that were essentially forced to export their raw materials. They'd load up these ships full of raw rubber, raw cotton, crude oil, and just send them to the mother country at incredibly cheap prices.
Because they didn't have the means to refine it themselves.
Right. So the mother country processes those raw materials in their big factories. They make these expensive tires, woven textiles, refined gasoline. And then, and here is the kicker, they turn around and sell those manufactured finished goods back to the colonies at a massive premium.
The wealth only flows in one direction. Mm-hmm. The raw material leaves cheap, the intelligence and labor are applied elsewhere, and the final product is sold back at a huge markup.
Exactly that dynamic, but applied to data today. Think about it. Today, countries are exporting their raw data, the daily interactions, the language, the behaviors of their own citizens, to a server sitting somewhere in Silicon Valley.
Mostly for free, too.
Completely for free. A California tech company trains a massive AI model on that raw data and then turns around and charges those exact same countries monthly subscription fees to buy back their own synthesized intelligence.
And this is where data really diverges from physical resources like oil or rubber. I mean, oil depletes. You burn a barrel of gasoline and, well, it's gone forever.
But data just keeps growing.
Data constantly generates. Every single day, every digital interaction creates more of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it goes way beyond just the economics. A nation's data is its collective memory. I mean, it's the cultural DNA and the historical footprint of its people.
Yeah, in that BG2 interview cited in the book, Huang says this really striking thing. He says, nobody wants a nuclear bomb, but everybody needs AI.
That quote is so perfectly distilled because nuclear weapons, you know, they sit in a silo. They are a deterrent.
Right. The whole goal is to build them so you never actually use them.
Exactly. But artificial intelligence is entirely different because it's integrated into everyday survival.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it runs public administration, healthcare diagnostics, educational curriculums, power grids.
It's the plumbing of modern society.
Yes. So if you rely on another nation for the cognitive infrastructure that runs your daily life, you have essentially surrendered true sovereignty. You might have physical borders, but you don't actually govern the intelligence shaping your society.
Okay, let me play devil's advocate for a second here because I can hear people asking this. If the AI gets the math right, or, you know, if it can summarize a 50-page legal brief perfectly, why does it actually matter if that AI was trained in California?
It's a fair question.
Right, because math is math, and a summary is a summary. What is the practical harm in using a foreign-trained model for just everyday tasks?
You have to look at it practically through the lens of human experience rather than just mathematics. The book provides this brilliant example regarding the concept of filial piety in Korea.
Oh, I loved this part.
Yeah, it's deeply rooted in Confucianism, centering on this profound, almost reverent respect and duty toward one's parents and ancestors.
It's absolutely foundational to how Korean society operates.
Right. Now, if a Korean child asks a U.S.-trained AI like just a standard version of GPT, Gemini, or Claude, what is filial piety?
Yeah.
That AI is going to answer based on its training data. And that data is overwhelmingly scraped from Western, specifically American, internet sources.
So it completely misses the mark.
Totally. The AI will likely frame the parent-child relationship through a Western lens.
Yeah.
It's going to talk about individualism, setting healthy boundaries, you know, the eventual independence of the child from the parent.
Which is perfectly normal, acceptable advice if you live in Ohio.
Exactly.
But it completely misses the deep historical weight of the concept if you're in Seoul.
It strips away the cultural nuance entirely. Because the AI's intelligence has an inherent worldview baked into its very architecture. It's not just summarizing facts. It is actively imposing a cultural lens on the user.
So if a country outsources its intelligence, they are quietly, almost invisibly, outsourcing their culture.
That's the danger. It's an erosion of cultural identity masquerading as technological convenience.
Which perfectly explains that crazy scene at the 2025 GTC event in Paris.
Oh, yeah.
You've got Jensen Huang on stage with French President Emmanuel Macron and the CEO of Mistral AI. And Huang just tells the crowd point blank, intelligence is an inalienable national resource. You can outsource many things, but it makes no sense to outsource intelligence itself.
And France is taking that warning incredibly seriously. I mean, they aren't just agreeing in principle. They are pouring massive resources into physical infrastructure.
Putting their money where their mouth is.
Big time. They partnered with NVIDIA to build a 1.4 gigawatt AI campus near Paris.
A 1.4 gigawatt campus, that is insane.
It's huge. And they deployed an 18,000 GPU AI cloud on top of it. And the entire purpose of this infrastructure is just to protect and promote the French language and European culture. They are literally building their own digital Aurelian way.
And when you read through this chapter, you start to realize France is just one player in this massive global arms race. But instead of competing for physical territory or, like, physical weapons, nations are racing for sovereign intelligence infrastructure.
Yeah, and what's fascinating is that every nation faces a completely different challenge in this race. I mean, if France is worried about protecting one language, imagine the absolute nightmare of trying to protect 22.
Right, which is exactly what India is facing.
India's linguistic landscape is just staggering. 22 official languages and literally thousands of distinct regional dialects. A Silicon Valley AI model, which is predominantly trained in English, simply cannot grasp that level of linguistic diversity.
Yeah, we just flatten it all out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the Indian government launched Project Hashini. They are partnering with massive local conglomerates like the Tata Group to build an AI ecosystem that understands India on its own terms. They're making sure their cultural and linguistic complexity isn't just flattened into some English-centric average.
Then you have Saudi Arabia, which is facing a totally different but equally massive economic transition. I mean, for nearly a century, they built their entire wealth and geopolitical power by refining oil.
Right, the ultimate physical resource.
Yeah. But now, through their Humane initiative, they're developing the Alam Arabic AI model. They're shifting from refining crude oil to refining raw data.
And the symbolism there is just incredible.
It really is. They are literally constructing AI data centers on the exact same sites where oil refineries used to sit.
It is the transition from the industrial age to the intelligence age captured in one single geographical footprint. It's wild. But you know, perhaps the most profound example of what digital sovereignty actually means comes from Ukraine.
This part of the book gave me chills because Ukraine is fighting a brutal kinetic war right now. Artillery, drones, trenches. And yet, amidst a literal fight for physical survival, their Ministry of Digital Transformation launched the Deya.AI LLM.
Yeah, a language model specifically designed for Ukrainian law and public services.
I mean, pulling resources to build an AI model while you are fighting a ground war, that proves this isn't some luxury tech project. It is basic survival.
They recognize that losing their data and losing their digital independence to a foreign power is simply another form of being conquered. I mean, they refuse to surrender their digital sovereignty even while they are fighting tooth and nail for their physical borders.
Which brings up a really tough reality, the challenge of catching up. Like, look at South Korea. They are playing a massive long game here.
Oh, absolutely.
At the APEC summit in Gyeongju in late 2024, they announced that 260,000 GPUs, these are the graphics processing units, the specialized silicon chips that basically act as the brains of AI, were being deployed to companies like Samsung, SK, Hyundai, and Naver, plus another 50,000 secured just for the government.
And by late 2025, they have this massive COEX project where five huge Korean tech companies are actively collaborating to build a uniquely Korean AI.
Right. But here's the crazy part.
The benchmarks.
The crucial detail about this whole South Korean effort is their awareness of their current limitations.
Yeah.
If you look at standard AI performance benchmarks, global giants like Google or OpenAI are scoring in the 70s.
Right.
But the Korean models, they're currently scoring in the 40s.
Yeah, which sounds bad on paper.
So they're knowingly investing billions into a system that is currently objectively worse than what they could just rent from the U.S.
Because this isn't about short-term rankings on some tech leaderboard. I mean, it is about long-term survival. You have to start building your own intelligence capacity today, even if it is currently inferior, because the alternative is just permanent dependency on a foreign intelligence apparatus.
To understand the engineering reality of how a country actually builds this, we really need to look at Huang's five-layer cake analogy from the book.
Yes, this is essential to understand.
So if a nation wants sovereign AI, they have to bake all five layers. The base layer, the absolute foundation, is energy.
You can't do anything without that.
Right. The second layer is the semiconductor chips, those GPUs. The third layer is infrastructure, meaning the physical data centers. The fourth layer is the AI models, the actual synthesized intelligence. And then the top layer is applications, the software that everyday people actually use.
And that cake analogy exposes a severe vulnerability for most nations, because you cannot just buy advanced chips layer 2 and claim you have sovereign AI.
Because if you don't have the foundation, the whole thing collapses.
Right.
Take that cluster of 260,000 GPUs in South Korea we just talked about. That requires the same amount of electricity as a small city.
Exactly.
If you don't have the electrical grid to power them, and more importantly, the power to cool them, that specialized silicon will literally melt.
It's a huge logistical bottleneck. Historically, national power was measured in very tangible physical ways. In the agrarian age, it was the size of your arable land. During the Industrial Revolution, it was your steel production.
In the 20th century, it was oil reserves and nuclear arsenals.
Right. But today, national power is measured by computing power. How many advanced chips do you have? And how much sustained energy can you feed them to produce intelligence?
Which fundamentally rewrites the geopolitical map. If energy is the base layer of this new world order, then China has a massive built-in structural advantage.
A huge advantage.
The sources note they currently produce twice as much energy as the United States. Meanwhile, northern European nations like Norway, Finland, Sweden, they suddenly possess this incredible geopolitical leverage simply because they have abundant, cheap hydro and wind power and cold climates.
Yeah, they can cool and power these massive data centers far more efficiently than almost anyone else on Earth. The bottleneck isn't just getting the chips, it's keeping the lights on once you plug them in.
This brings up a really critical question regarding the U.S. strategy here. The sources explicitly mention that China has a massive talent pool and holds roughly 70% of AI patents.
That's a wild statistic, 70%.
Right. So if the United States wants to maintain its lead in this intelligence arms race, why not just use strict export controls, like just completely cut competitors off from these advanced American design chips, starve them of layer two of the cake?
Well, that is the instinct of traditional geopolitics, right? Just blockade the resource. But Huang offers a highly counterintuitive warning about that exact strategy. He argues that if the U.S. uses export controls to completely exclude China, China won't just stop developing AI.
Because they have the foundation.
Exactly. They have the energy infrastructure and they have the engineering talent.
It's like trying to cut off a major competitor's access to the iOS App Store. They aren't going to stop using smartphones. They're just going to go out and build Android.
That is the precise danger. They will build a completely independent, parallel technology ecosystem from the ground up. Huang warns, and I quote, "We are not losing market share. We could lose future standards."
Wow.
Now, if half the global economy ends up running on an entirely different technological stack, the U.S. loses its standard-setting influence entirely. And this is why Huang's alternative strategy is so vital. He is positioning himself, and by extension, U.S. technology, as a sort of tech diplomat for the West.
Which explains why he is blanketing the globe with infrastructure. I mean, in June 2025, NVIDIA deployed 3,000 exaflops of computing power across Europe.
That number is almost hard to comprehend.
It is. For context, an exaflop is essentially a quintillion calculations per second. It is a mind-bending amount of computational force.
And the strategy there is to make American hardware and software the bedrock standard globally. But doing it in a way that respects that Westphalian concept we talked about earlier. You provide the loom, the hardware, and the computing power, but you let each nation weave their own cultural tapestry on top of it.
So you allow them to maintain their sovereign AI while remaining basically tethered to your technological ecosystem?
Exactly. It's brilliant.
But this requires a complete redefinition of what national security actually means. The book really highlights this distinction between small n, small s national security, which is your traditional military defense, border patrols, munitions. Mm-hmm.
Physical stuff.
Exactly. Versus capital N, capital S national security. The latter is about economic dynamism, industrial productivity, and cultural survival in the 21st century.
Huang points out that very soon, every industry will produce intelligence. Car manufacturers aren't just going to stamp metal and assemble engines anymore. They will produce driving intelligence. Pharmaceutical companies won't just mix chemicals in a lab. They will produce biological intelligence.
And if a nation does not possess the sovereign AI infrastructure to support that kind of cognitive industrial output,
their entire economy will stagnate. Period.
We are standing at the absolute edge of a $100 trillion industrial revolution here. And the technological speed is just staggering. I mean, for decades, the tech world was governed by Moore's Law, the old rule that computing power basically doubles every 2 years.
All right, the golden rule of Silicon Valley.
But the book notes that AI advancement is just blowing past Moore's Law. NVIDIA is planning to reduce token production costs.
Mm-hmm.
And a token is basically the basic building block of AI thought, sort of like a syllable in a word. They plan to reduce that cost by a million times in the next 10 years.
A million times cheaper. Which means intelligence will soon be as abundant and as inexpensive as electricity itself.
It's hard to even wrap your head around.
It is, but that abundance forces a binary choice on every single nation.
You are either an intelligence producer or an intelligence consumer.
Exactly. You either build the infrastructure to export your synthesized knowledge and innovate, or you become a perpetual consumer, paying a massive premium to import someone else's worldview. Just to keep your hospitals, your schools, and your transit systems running.
So Jensen Huang isn't really selling silicon chips. He is traveling the world, basically teaching nations how to construct the digital walls necessary to survive as sovereign entities in this new era.
Because without those walls, a nation's data, its most precious territory, is entirely defenseless.
Which leaves us with a final lingering thought for you, the listener, to explore on your own. We've established today that our data is our modern territory. It's our cultural DNA. And to build these massive sovereign AIs, to construct these digital walls for our respective nations, we must constantly feed the intimate details of our daily lives into these systems.
Right. The raw material has to come from somewhere.
Exactly. But if that is the strict requirement for national survival, who exactly within the nation controls that resulting intelligence? Does the everyday citizen truly own their piece of that digital territory?
Or does this new digital sovereignty ultimately belong entirely to the state and to the megacorporations managing the AI factories?
It's something to deeply consider the next time you casually ask an AI for an answer. Until next time.
This program is provided by Lawyer Kyungjin Kim.